Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker podcast. My name is Sam Long. Today I'm joined by Squawker editor Will Hall. How are you, Will?
I'm doing very well. And, good to be here.
Sorry, and social media guru Nathan Bliss. How are you, Nathan?
Very good, thank you. A bit cold, but apart from that. So.
Very cold in London. Yeah. So domestic football is back this weekend, but we're going to be kicking off with some standout stats from the Nations League, which everyone seems to have fallen in love with. Our first number is 20, after Harry Kane proved to be England's hero yet again and became the 11th quickest player to score at least 20 times for England, doing so in just 35 games. So do we think there is a better striker in the world right now?
This obviously refers to the Gareth Southgate comments.
Absolutely.
I think he was a bit giddy maybe when he said that. So the benchmarks for that kind of claim, you're talking about Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo. Harry Kane is kind of like, seems to be the only striker who's approaching the same level of consistency season upon season with that kind of like output in terms of goals. And the other thing you could say is that I believe neither Messi nor Ronaldo were part of their last senior international squad. So in the context of like international level, is there any sort of striker, goal scorer, like doing the, like producing the goods right now in this very sort of small time frame, then you can kind of let it slide a bit more
without too much ridicule.
But the other thing I would say is that if you're looking for a game in which Kane showcases his goal scoring ability at its best, it probably wasn't that one, because he'd missed quite a few chances. There was like the Stones flick on that he kind of fluffed early on in the game. And there was that bit where Kalinic, the Croatian goalkeeper, cleans out Sterling, and he's kind of just and Kane picks it up and then could potentially do better, a bit more accurate to get it over the I think Lovren's head or Vida's head. But obviously he did score the winning goal. Quite a clutch moment. I think that was his first in 757 minutes. I think I read off Opta. So that's quite a barren run. I think it's his first goal from open play since the Colombia game, potentially. At least some point during the World Cup. Anyway, but there are other elements of his play that were on display during that game. I think his hold-up play and passing ability in that sort of 10-minute to 30-minute spell during the game really came to the fore. You remember the chance for Sterling where Gomez just picks out a really sort of well-weighted and sort of quite hefty ball into him. Kane takes a nice touch, holds it up, and then just slides it through. The weight of pass is perfect for Sterling to get that chance where he's kind of one-on-one with the goalkeeper, should really score, but then squanders it. So he kind of, when Messi and Ronaldo eventually retire, go away, he's at the forefront to be the sort of best goal scorer in football, especially considering those around him, like Kylian Mbappe, is not really producing the same number of goals. Mario Icardi seems to be the only like peer of his age range who's getting into those 20s with the same level of consistency. But I mean, he's a much more limited player than Kane, so I don't think Kane needs to really worry about just being the best goal scorer in the world when he's got so many other elements to his game. But yeah,
so England are into their second semi-final in 2 years. Do we think the team's displays have indicated that they are learning their lessons and they're maturing almost?
Yeah, definitely. I think what struck me in the Croatia game was I couldn't help but thinking back to that Wally with the Brolly game and the differences between that England and the way there was panic when we went behind against Croatia, the way there was kind of no set tactical plan really. There was just a load of good players thrown together and just trying to produce something. But under Southgate, you can see there's a real belief and there's a real ethic within the team and they all want to work together to get the result. I think that was kind of emphasised by when we actually did get the equaliser. Normally what you'd see from an England team looking back over the years is like almost a panic, like we need to get this goal, otherwise we'll be destroyed by the press or we're going to get criticised. But what they did was just keep calm and thought, you know what, we're going to get the goal, let's just play as we normally do. They kept to the plan, there was no hoofing it forward, it was still playing through midfield with Ali brought on and Lingard brought on as well, who eventually produced the goods, Lingard with the goal. So I think there's been a lot of lessons learned in terms of the progression of play under Southgate. And what was really enjoyable for me as well was the fact that we play with a four at the back with the 4-3-3. So now we've got a number of different options. So we've gone from the five at the back that was so good during the World Cup that kind of took opponents by surprise, if you will. But now we've moved to the four at the back and we almost look as good, if not more potent, moving forward. So the fact that we've got those different options as well, that we can go to if the game isn't coming towards us, we can switch to a different formation. I think that's really exciting. And it's definitely a lot more positive for England than it has been in a number of years, in my opinion.
I think considering that, like, at the World Cup, as you said, the back three was so solid and so important and almost became like a cult sort of thing because of, like, the Harry Maguire memes, and they're quite, like, lovable characters, really. But I think the introduction of Joe Gomez, like, does take England a step forward, and certainly did during that game. And we've spoken about him so many times in this podcast that I don't really want to dwell too much on him, but I will say that he's been compared to Bobby Moore not once but twice this season, and any sort of even-handed pundit or journalist would go nowhere near that comparison. It's like, I mean, you wouldn't go along with it, but I mean, it's a testament to the fact that his standing in the game is so high that people are making these comparisons. And yeah, so we've come forward in terms of personnel. I do think it's a bit of a shame that we only seem to be able to score through set pieces.
Yeah,
And like, just giving Sam Allardyce the opportunity to criticise England's goal scoring from open play is horrifying. Yeah.
But I think there's a lot to be said for that, though. At the international level, when it's such fine margins, then if you're good at set pieces, then you're going to come up with the goods of the
exactly moments. And we were talking about the Joe Gomez long ball throw in, because Liverpool were mocked in some quarters. I think it was Richard Keys who went in on them for hiring a throw in coach to give them like an extra couple of yards on their throw, but lo and behold, the equaliser comes via a Joe Gomez throw. And I would say that I use the word it's a shame that we're scoring all goals from set pieces, because our stuff from open play was really good in that 10 to 30 minute spell and in other pockets of the game. It's that cutting edge that we need from Sterling and Rashford, who of late don't seem... Well, Sterling, obviously used to get a lot of stick for not being able to finish and has improved, but I mean, that one-on-one, he should have really put it away. Whereas Rashford, it seems like he used to be, in my mind, quite an instinctive finisher when he first broke onto the scene. And I don't know what's happened now. Maybe he's been playing on too long on the, a bit too much on the wings now. But
playing too long under Mourinho, I would say.
Yeah. Exactly, because the way that sort of Kane drops deep and then the two wingers end up being the most advanced players, it's almost like turns Kane into a playmaker in certain moments of attacks. And that's when you need Rashford and Sterling to really sort of improve their clinical ability. But that will come. I mean, like I said, we play some really good stuff from open play, and it's just a case of like building momentum. A lot of the time, finishing is based on confidence, and that's something you have to sort of cultivate. And the
finals next summer. Do we think that England have got a realistic chance of winning it?
Definitely, I think we have. I think if you look at like we mentioned the way they won with the set pieces. If you look at someone like Iceland in the Euros, for example, where we 1-0, that we just couldn't get that goal. We really would have wished for something to come off like a set piece or something against Iceland, but the fact that they did manage to get the win just proves that that's the ethic within the group and that's the kind of togetherness. But if you look at the teams that have qualified, I think we stand a really good chance of winning something. Whether it actually matters an awful lot is something to be 7. Debated.
7.5 million euros goes to the goes to the winner.
Would we get a star on the
shirt?
Yeah,
half a star maybe.
Yeah, a silver star or like a bronze star.
Yeah, I think
either way I'll be buying that kit.
yeah, potential PR opportunity there, isn't there? A bit of a sponsorship, but I think it doesn't really matter in terms of overall, but I think in terms of from the group itself, to win something together as a group, the fact that we haven't won something for England for such a long period, even if it's something as small as the Nations League, that could be what just gives the players a little bit extra to in the next World Cup or Euros, we could really make an impact and go further than we have done.
So moving on, next up is the number five, which is the amount of goals Belgium conceded against Switzerland, which cost them top spot in Group 2. And I'd like to know what you think this meltdown says about Roberto Martinez's managerial skills.
Nothing new, really, because we kind of always knew he couldn't organise a defence to save his life.
After going 2-0 up as well, it was a complete capitulation. Yeah,
for me, it's just overcoaching. Like, he's just trying too hard. He's putting too much emphasis on... He's trying to be too clever. The formation that he's got is good against lower teams because they're not going to exploit the gaps in behind. But, like, example, Nasser Chadli playing as a wing-back. Like, against better teams, that's going to be exploited. And Switzerland aren't that good a team, really, but they still manage to exploit that weakness. And I think it's just being a bit too clever, really. And that's how we saw with these, like, Wigan days, for example, Everton days. Sometimes his tactical nous things do pull off. For example, when he put Lukaku on the right with Everton, that really did work. But sometimes it just comes back to bite him. I think that's what happened again.
I think he was like... It does teach us about how, on the back of an impressive World Cup showing, a manager can just become flavour of the month. Because, I mean, his name... In the grand scheme of things, his name shouldn't have been anywhere near that Real Madrid job. But it was, and there were quite convincing reports. The suggestions were that Thibaut Courtois was sort of lobbying for him to take over from Lopetegui. But yeah, he should have enough in the bank after the World Cup third place finish that he survives this, and also the fact that it's the Nations League, and I don't think anyone's like... I mean, the qualifying groups are probably, on balance, more important. So he should get through this, but it's just,
They're going to qualify anyway.
There's a reason as well that, like, he's the Belgian manager and not a bigger name, despite all the talent at their disposal. The Belgian FA just can't really afford the salary for a big, a more high-profile name. So what it does is it gives my personal opinion of him is quite a limited manager an opportunity to work with not a limited manager, but a manager with, like, very obvious faults, the opportunity to work with a very, very talented squad, and you can do good things with that opportunity. And he has, to his credit, like, sort of maximised the opportunity. There's a reason there's not a bigger coach.
Just a note on Switzerland's performance as well, because they played really well. Shaqiri in particular was really pivotal in that game. One thing I wanted to pick up on was Seferovic. The only time really I've ever seen him previously, all I've ever seen him do is miss easy chances regularly. I was looking at some of his stats. He's never scored more than 10 league goals in a season at club level. But he's just on fire at the moment. Absolutely on fire. He got into our combined 11, didn't he?
I think it was so difficult not to put him in.
Yeah, that's the thing, but you can't really not include him because it's such a surprise. He's just come out of nowhere and just banging all the goals in, and he's never really shown this form in his life before. This is like the best form of his life almost that he's in at the moment.
Well, on the receiving end of that, I should say, was obviously Courtois, which you touched on there, Will. And I wanted to just get your thoughts on his form for club and country since winning the Best Goalkeeper Award. So he's played 11 games, conceded 19 goals, kept 4 clean sheets, including 2 5 goal thrashings. Not exactly ideal for a man who's just moved to Real Madrid.
Yeah, no, I mean, to be honest, Courtois has been not poor, but he's not really been that good for a while. I mean, if you look at Chelsea last season, you look at the Barcelona game, Messi's first goal and he nutmegged him from a really tight angle. I mean, Messi's unbelievable, but he should never have scored from that angle. And there's been a lot of occasions, especially last season, that he didn't cover himself in glory. And I think he's been going on for a while now, but it just kind of begs the question, where does he really go? Is he really that good, or was it just the hype from Chelsea and that kind of solid defence? But what do you think?
I mean, he seems like one of those goalkeepers who's continuously having to reprove his elite credentials. He, as you said, wins the Best Goalkeeper Award. I remember we were having a discussion about, like, whether Real Madrid had really made a high profile, like, big name signing in recent seasons, and it completely escaped my mind that they just spent like 45 million or however much it was on Courtois. And yeah, he said since joining Real Madrid, he's already been forced to sort of defend his ability to play with the ball at his feet. And if he's not providing like sort of David De Gea-esque spectacular stops, then like what is he providing? Yeah, so I mean, he's had his moments where he's performed well. I think the Atletico Madrid draw was a good performance from him. Mm. And yeah, he's just he's coming. He's got a big game ahead of him in the Roma fixture, which should decide who tops their group. And he's obviously Solari's come in and given him the Champions League sort of spot ahead of Navas. So I mean, he's got to like repay that faith.
Yeah, he does need to prove, like you said, he does need to reprove himself again for like the 10th time or whatever it is, because at the moment he's kind of behind that Oblak, Ter Stegen, De Gea type, the top three, if you like, of goalkeepers.
Yeah, and I think as well, because of the manner in which he left Chelsea, got a lot of Chelsea fans' backs up, and that doesn't help him as well, because if you become unpopular with certain fan bases, then every single move is scrutinised, and social media becomes awash with like, for instance, it doesn't help him that Kepa, I think, played for Spain ahead of De Gea that same night and kept a clean sheet. So, I mean, Chelsea fans are like, well, Kepa's keeping clean sheets. Well, Courtois getting smashed for five. And as well, I think a lot of Real Madrid, it was not a lot, but it's previously been suggested that their decision not to sign Kepa last season, when I think they could have got him for something like €20 million, is being shown up a bit now.
Yeah, definitely. And I think when, like you said, when you've been criticised, when you've like pushed so much for a move, it puts so much pressure on you going to a new team to perform straight away. And when you go into a club like Real Madrid where the pressure's so high anyway, maybe he's just fallen a victim of that pressure. He's putting himself under too
much
pressure.
Yeah, I mean, he's by no means the like the sort of the one thing that's let Real Madrid down this season. I think it's just those figures that you've read out at the start of that don't help his cause.
And he's not getting much protection either, really, from the Real Madrid defence. Like Ramos and Varane have been in very poor form, really, for the whole of the season. It's not just Courtois, so he hasn't had the best of cover, to be honest.
Okay, so final point on the Nations League. We have the number 3,061, which represents the number of days since the Netherlands men's senior side last won a tournament semi-final. So they eliminated France and drew with Germany. Just how big of an achievement is this for the Dutch?
So I spoke to one Netherlands fan the other day who said that they thought Ronald Koeman and Virgil van Dijk both should have been brought into the setup ages ago. Mm. So now that they have and things are going well, I think this is kind of a vindication of the general sense that things are finally going right after they've missed those two major tournaments. It's crazy to think that the last major tournament they were at, which I believe 2012 World Cup, they did quite well. They finished third, I think, after winning the sort of the final playoff game, whatever.
Yeah, so, Van Gaal, wasn't it?
That was under Van Gaal, yeah. I mean, you look at their 11, there's very obvious positions in which they have quite dodgy personnel. We were talking about Babel, and although he's in good form and sort of he's meriting his place, perhaps you kind of look at that and you don't consider it a sort of any team that has him leading the line, an elite team. But they do have like so many sort of young talents that have the potential to become like the next generation of world beaters in De Ligt and De Jong, that I mean the future does look bright.
So you said that De Jong there, he completed 100% of his passes in the first half versus Germany, 43 out of 43. Do we think he's really good enough for Barcelona or Manchester City? He's been linked with the big boys, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he is. Yeah, I think if you look at, I haven't watched him on that many occasions, but I made a point to just kind of watch his performance and just kind of concentrate on what he was doing during that game, because I haven't seen a lot of him, and I was very, very impressed with what I saw in terms of his technical qualities. Outstanding. But we do have to be careful with someone so young, like Sancho, for example, because Sancho's kind of come on the scene. You just need to be a little bit careful because they're so young, and also because he plays in Dutch league as well. That's something you need to be careful of, because there's a lot of players that come out of that and don't do so well afterwards. But what's clear is that he has got that technical quality needed. I think he just needs to, if he does get that move, he needs to be playing every single game, which I'm not sure he will.
I certainly wouldn't say he would play every week.
Yeah, so if reports are to be believed, it looks like Man City have sort of won the race. It looks like they've been talking to Ajax for ages about this one. It's probably going to go ahead. The suggestions are that it might go ahead in January and then they'll loan him back to Ajax. I mean, from my point of view, I don't see him as the player they need, because he's like that sort of deep-lying playmaker, the role that De Bruyne currently sort of occupies. I mean, he's not that far back from injury, and they do have other sort of, I mean, the same night he was putting in that performance against Germany, and you mentioned the passing stat. I mean, they weren't like the most incisive passes, and they weren't like taking Germany to pieces with like sort of line sort of breaking defense splitting, like searching balls through. But you also had like Zinchenko, I think, doing all right for Ukraine, and Delph, who we didn't mention earlier, having like one of the best games I've seen from an England player in that position for ages. I mean, that's obviously the position that England needs someone in, because Dier doesn't seem up to it. Henderson seems a bit too sort of too much of a shuttler to sort of really sort of keep hold of the ball, maybe take it past and then open up passing lanes. So Man City have got De Bruyne, who can do that sort of deep-lying playmaker thing. And then they've got Zinchenko, and I mean, Zinchenko probably is off soon, but Delph looks like a credible backup option, so much so that they don't really need to go out and spend like £80 million on a centre mid. Same for Barca, really, because Arthur's, since joining, being hailed as like potentially the next Xavi. For me, I think Man City are probably better off looking at like a Fernandinho replacement, because he's getting on a bit older, and they need that sort of shuttler, sort of all action midfielder to kind of take the reins off him, because he's been one of the most underrated Premier League players for some time now.
Yeah. What Manchester City and Barcelona are thinking about is they're thinking of that Busquets role that De Jong's so good at, in terms of not necessarily breaking up the play like you said, like Fernandinho, but that ability to get the ball off the back four and then play it between the lines. They might not look that incisive, but it's so important in a team like Manchester City or Barcelona. The role that Busquets does for them is absolutely invaluable, and whilst Fernandinho is brilliant at what he does, he's 33 now, I think, if I'm right saying.
Yeah, so. But I think if you're looking at, so De Jong, you'd expect him to be like the player in that midfield who's passing the ball the most.
Yeah,
and if you look at Man City, then it's De Bruyne playing the most passes.
But is that because they haven't got someone like De Jong? Because Fernandinho, say for example, Fernandinho retires at the end of the season and De Jong comes in, I think Guardiola would prefer a De Jong style player in there rather than a Fernandinho player.
I mean, absolutely. There's no. I think this is more of a question of like, this is a potentially once in a generation talent that we need to come along and get to ensure that no one else gets him. And there's obviously something we can do with that.
Yeah.
I just think that they'd be better off investing elsewhere, because it does feel like a lot of money. But I mean, then again, it's like,
or they could just sign him and then sell him on if they don't actually end up using him.
Yeah, exactly. And also like, it's perhaps a bit churlish to like look at that one position and say, oh, they don't need someone there, because like who's getting into that Man City team? Like you're gonna have to put your hand in your pocket to buy any player who merits a place in that 11 over any of the current starters.
Yeah, the fact that the Guardiola or the Man City hierarchy are pinpointing De Jong suggests to me that, like you said, even though they've got so many options, like people like Gundogan as well, that we haven't even
looked at.
Delph, Zinchenko, they've just signed Claudio Gomez from PSG. They've got the kid that was on loan at Girona that they couldn't register, that midfielder there. So the fact that they're going after De Jong suggests to me that
he's kind of a level above, though, because although he's kind of like in the same age range as certain players, I think he's 21. He's quite a bit more experienced.
Yeah.
He's like, he, for instance, he's played in that Europa League final against Manchester United a couple of years ago. He came off the bench.
Yeah,
Delitt as well. Yeah. Like, I think he's 19 and he's probably the most experienced teenage defender in any of the top leagues.
Yeah, that's
Europe.
Just invaluable. But what that suggests to me, the fact that they're pinpointing him and they've got so many midfielders, suggests to me that Guardiola is looking at the next evolution of this team, and that's where he's gonna go more towards that kind of the Xavi, Busquets, Iniesta,
I mean, rather than, as we've said before, he changes his lineup in every other game. So
yeah.
What's to say that
just another option for them?
Yeah. So now we're going to look ahead to some of the biggest games around Europe this weekend, and we're going to start again with Wembley, where Spurs host Chelsea. Harry Kane has scored just 4 goals in 10 games against Chelsea. Do we think he can use his great Wembley form to set that record straight? And, of course, ends Chelsea's unbeaten start.
I mean, maybe less so Kane, but I think just Spurs players in general are done with Wembley. Like, you look at that Christian Eriksen interview that came out the other week, where he said like we've got training pitches that are better than the last time after the defeat to Man City, which was played on a pitch that just hosted NFL game. So they've lost all their big games there this season as well. Like Liverpool, Barcelona, Man City. I mean, it feels like the sort of uncertainty regarding whether when they move into the new stadium hasn't allowed them to attach themselves to Wembley to quite the same extent. So when we're looking at these kind of records, it's difficult to really imagine, to gauge how effective they'll be on the actual events of the pitch. But yeah, Kane has come up with a couple clutch moments recently for the England winner. He was also instrumental in that PSV win for Spurs a couple of weeks ago, just before the international break, which sort of kept their Champions League hopes alive. So he'll be up for it. But I think if I'm looking at a player to watch, I think Dele Alli is potentially one who's got 5 goals in his last 4 games against Chelsea, 2 of which were braces. And also I think his sort of not most recent, but the one before brace against them was the one that ended their winning run of the league, the season they went on to win the Premier League. So he's got form in terms of like upsetting Chelsea momentum. So I'm looking at the Spurs team. I think Dele Alli could be one who really steps up in this one, as long as he gets over his hotel escapades.
I think Son's going to be an important figure as well. He's well rested after the national break. I fancy him to put in a good performance. And it's just interesting with Spurs that their sort of attacking players almost used to sort of pick themselves, but they've got real competition in there now. I know Lamella's probably not going to play because he's was on international duty as recently as sort of Wednesday night. But yeah, it's going to be a great game at Wembley.
Yeah, but I mean, losing, if Lamella doesn't play, that'll be a big blow to Tottenham, because he's really, really important. He's got something different to all the other Tottenham players, especially with Eriksen missing recently as well. The fact that he's playing on the right-hand side, he can cut in on the left, and not only can he shoot or cross, but he can pick out a pass to other players, and that's something that's really important, especially for people like Kane and, like you said, Son and Lucas Moura and players like that. So if he doesn't play and Eriksen doesn't end up playing, there's going to be a lot of, like you said, there's going to be a lot of importance on Kane and Alli in that partnership there. And to be fair, no matter how, say, Spurs do play badly, when you've got people like Kane and Alli playing, you're always going to have a chance to score. And so Harry Kane, he's... if they are playing badly, you can rely on someone like Kane just to pop up with something.
I think they all know that they really need this one as well. Yeah. Like, they've just been sort of like battered away by all the big boys who have come into town this season so far. So they really need to sort of like reassert their credentials as a top club.
Yeah, definitely. It's fallen away a bit, isn't it? Yeah. The last kind of 2 months or
just
so.
Despite the fact that they enjoyed their best ever start to a Premier League season.
Yeah. I
mean, it's crazy, isn't it? They feel like they're on a downer even though.
Yeah. But it's because Chelsea, Liverpool and Man City are doing so well, it's just been overshadowed by the fact that even though Tottenham are having the best start ever, it's still not quite good enough to be those top teams. Mm.
As for Chelsea, their key man is obviously Hazard. He's completed the most take-ons in the Premier League this season, but he hasn't scored now since early October against Southampton. Do we think he's going to get back in the saddle this weekend?
Well, that's an interesting one, because there's been a lot of people talking about Hazard, about how inform he is.
Oh, yeah, I don't think he's going to have that 40-goal season that Jake and Mo were on about a few previous podcasts ago.
It's interesting, because there's a lot of people talking about Hazard and how, like you said, how he's going to score 40 goals or whatever. And then there was all the people talking about Salah and how he's had a slow start to the season. But like you said, Hazard hasn't scored since they beat Southampton away from home on the 7th of October. But Salah's got like seven goals in his last eight games.
I think Salah's sort of come back into form a lot of people were talking about him a few games ago, and he's since then scored a few more. Yeah. Hazard's obviously, I think, eight games for club and country without a goal. Yeah. But I would say the difference between him and Salah is that when Hazard's not... this is one argument. I don't necessarily subscribe to it. But the argument would be that, like, when Salah's not scoring, he's like not contributing much. That's the part I disagree with, because he's got other elements to his game, like dribbling, work space. But when Hazard's not scoring, he's like... He's like taking on like three opponents, like creating chance after chance.
Yeah, creating space for other people to.
Yeah,
support.
I think he's less a goal scorer first and foremost. So it's perhaps testament to him that he's sort of like he's competing with these guys at the top of the goal scoring.
It was always going to be a big ask for him to score the type of goals that we talked about, because he's never been that player.
I think the idea was that Sarri's come in and Sarri relies on his sort of less so on his centre forward and more so on his like sort of auxiliary forwards on each wing.
Mm. Yeah.
And they thought, oh, he would... Hazard in this system is going to be a bit more effective in front of a goal, and perhaps he will. Perhaps this is a streak. Yeah. I mean, he has been injured and missed a couple of games in that period, we should say.
But a lot of the arguments were built around him sort of linking up with Giroud as well, and obviously Sarri sort of toyed with playing Morata. Actually, it'll be interesting to see if he plays Morata at the weekend. He got in the Spain squad, didn't he?
Yeah.
Mr. Sitter by all
accounts. Yeah, but that's going to be a really difficult decision, because if you play Giroud, who isn't scoring, and then Hazard doesn't score, they both don't score. But then if you play Morata, it's not going to help Hazard, but they're not scoring anyway. So what do you do if you're sorry? Because you can't really win both ways. Mm. You either play a striker that's really out of form, or you play a striker that's really out of form.
They've got goals elsewhere, like from like Willian or Pedro.
Yeah,
I think.
I think Pedro's
fitness on those
with them not scoring the amount of goals that they need to at the moment. Chelsea, even though they are winning, Pedro will be really important to them, I think, because he's the one player out of all of them who has that lethal touch from the. He's like, almost like a wide forward.
Mm.
And if he does get chances, he will finish. I think he's going to be important.
There's also Barkley will be looking to like pick up where he left off.
Yeah,
and that's quite an interesting subplot to that game, because obviously there was a transfer tussle between Spurs and Chelsea.
Yeah, and the talking about the midfield as well. Barkley, the only midfielder really who offers a goal threat. If you look at Kovacic, Jorginho, Kante, they're not going to score the goals that you need to from midfield. So there's a lot of pressure on people like Hazard, Morata, Giroud, and Pedro to score.
But I think that's common. I mean, that's just the front line.
But
the pressure's on the front line.
But at Napoli, you had people like Hamsik there, who is a regular goal scorer from midfield. So it's going to be difficult for, because Barkley's not going to produce the same amount of goals that Hamsik did for him. So there's going to be a lot more reliance on the front three.
Or on Marcos Alonso, who obviously put Spurs to the sword with his own brace, I think, a couple of games back.
Mm-hmm.
So elsewhere in the Premier League, Liverpool travelled to Watford, and the Reds have conceded three goals on two of their last three visits to Vicarage Road. Do we think the Reds can keep up their 12-match unbeaten run?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is a very, very different team, Liverpool team, to the ones that have travelled to Watford in the past. If you look at their defensive solidity, this is something that Liverpool haven't had since Benitez, that kind of real solid base that they've got.
Yeah, it's a lot different because it's a, I mean, I know what you mean. Yeah,
they haven't. They it's don't
like
really
the,
play
the defend. The team they defend as a team more
yeah,
so than
exactly.
Benitez would have had like Mascarado yeah. sort of like.
Say if they go to Watford and they don't play necessarily well, you would still bat them to get maybe a 1-0 or 2-0 win with a bit of magic mm-hmm. from the front line. Whereas in previous seasons, you always say against someone like Watford, as you can see from the goals before. They're going to concede, but this Liverpool team don't look like conceding, so you'll always bat them to score.
Yeah, and also we should note in relation to the unbeaten runners, like Watford didn't win either of those games. I remember them being tough games, but they weren't wins for Watford, who have been sort of a bit of a very streaky team this year. I mean, they obviously had that like six game winning run, which put them in very good stead. I think they're seventh currently, and then went five games without a win after their big win against Spurs, and then back-to-back wins. But now I think in recent matches they've failed to beat two of the worst teams in the league in Newcastle and Southampton. Yeah. So
they do seem to be one of those teams who find the extra 10% at home when the big boys come to town.
That's true.
Watford are a really interesting team because there's a lot of similar teams to Watford in terms of you don't really know how they're going to turn up on the day. They could either blow you away with people like Delafeu, Decore in the team, Troy Deeney, and now they've got Peñaranda as well coming back, who's just got his work permit after 3 years. I think he's been at Watford, which is interesting. But Watford could easily turn up and, like you said, might have a scalp on Liverpool, but they might also roll over. So it's a difficult one to call with someone like Watford.
The other thing that we should throw in the mix is how much Klopp should rotate potentially with PSG on the horizon as well.
True, because that is potentially like game of the season for them. I think that could decide the Champions League group either way.
Do you think Klopp has seen Mbappe and Neymar going off injured and thought, oh, just?
I mean, it might be tempting to go all guns blazing. On that note, Mbappe looks like he'll probably be back. Because they issued the statement on the sort of medical report. I think they're going to be monitored for another 48 hours. But the initial results, so it was just like a bruised shoulder for Mbappe, whereas Neymar's potentially out for a longer spell. Either way, I don't think they should be resting players because Liverpool needs to make progress in the Premier League. This is a big weekend for them in terms of Chelsea playing Spurs. Chelsea could drop points, fall away, so they need the win basically to sort of put daylight between themselves and Chelsea.
This game will really kind of highlight where Klopp's priorities are. If he plays his full strength team, then we know that he's going all out for everything. He's trying to win everything. Whereas if he does rest, what that indicates is that he's probably more going towards the European and then hoping that his players can produce.
Because Man City have got their annual 4-0 win over West Ham this weekend. So that's another reason why the 3 points are necessary. I think Mo has previously on podcasts suggested that Klopp's not really using the depth of his squad to the same extent. What I would say is that his depth has been injured. The players like Lallana, Keita.
Yeah.
So he's had to kind of use the big boys. I think we'll see changes to the midfield just because he has been changing the midfield so frequently, and he's not really nailed the formula. You either go with a sort of double pivot of like Fabinho and someone else, and then Shaqiri is number 10 because Shaqiri and Fabinho are more used to that midfield three, or you sort of make it a bit more of a flatter front three and have Milner, Wijnaldum and I think Henderson's potentially not back, but Keita there are sort of all like shuttling midfielders. I've used the word shuttling like 4 times on this podcast. You have to bleep a few of them out.
I guess you could argue that playing Shaqiri would be him using the sort of squad depth, but then at the moment with his form he'd probably be starting anyway.
That's another issue. It's like we don't really have early on in the season he was playing Milner and Wijnaldum every game, two midfielders you'd expect to sort of fall back onto the bench after they signed Keita and Fabinho, and they were immense in those first few games. And now it's sort of become, he's getting to the point where he's kind of maybe a little bit under pressure to sort of phase Fabinho into the team. There's already links away for him. How credible they are, I can't really speak to. But so he's kind of, he's coming to the crunch really with nailing that midfield formula.
How close do you think it'd be interesting, because with Solanke's performance in midweek with
that back heel chip was
unbelievable. I mean,
it's just what, he's like, he scored like one goal at senior level, so I mean, for all you can say, oh, this is, you can criticise Klopp for not giving youngsters a chance, I mean, Solanke's not really taken the opportunities he has been given.
I'd say it's difficult as a young player if you're coming on for Firmino in like the last 10 minutes a game to make an impact. But with Firmino not scoring, like, how close would he be to get saying to Solanke, come
well,
on,
the
mate.
Other issue he's had is that Sturridge has sort of become the Sturridge from a few years ago and is now like sort of
the West Brom version.
Like, because if you're looking at sort of, if you're looking at 10 minutes left and you're bringing on Sturridge or Solanke to get a goal, you're choosing Sturridge.
Also, it was quite telling that I can't remember what game I think it was, maybe the Red Star defeat, but he brought on Origi. I just thought, I've completely forgotten. Here he is getting into the team ahead of Solanke.
But if you look at it just on form, say if you did have Solanke and Sturridge on the bench and Firmino was coming off injured, purely on form in terms of goals scored in the international or whatever, Solanke would be the one to go on.
How about Sturridge or Solanke?
Yeah, because he's scored the most recently, hasn't he?
No,
that's not how it works, though. Who scored the most recent goal?
I think Solanke is still paying for the fact that he stayed at Chelsea for so long, because you've got nothing to hold him up against, because he literally hasn't played any senior football. So there's no sort of moment where you can go, oh yeah, he did this when he came on, or when he started he did this, because he literally has nothing on his CV really.
He should have gone on loan, I think. Because if you look at Wilson, I know Woodburn hasn't played a lot at Sheffield United, but...
Yeah, I think apparently there's reports they're thinking about calling him back even.
But if you look at Wilson, how good he's played with Derby, Solanke's probably looking, thinking, I probably should have gone just to get a bit more game time.
Yeah, he was kind of like, you do see this with young players sometimes, where they're caught in between, like, being the backup striker for a big club and not really getting much game time, but they're the one you turn to when you sort of... when you're making that like 75th minute substitution to replace your striker, and being a young player who's just like can see that their route to the first team is getting blocked so extensively that you have to go out on loan. So it can be an awkward position to be almost like closer to the first team than not.
But I think
young players,
I think it tells you a lot, sorry Sam, it tells you a lot about a young player when someone like Harry Wilson, for example, if he went on loan to Derby and didn't do anything, if he didn't play at all well, and then he went back to Liverpool, that might damage his reputation with Liverpool, because you think, okay, he's gone on loan to Derby, hasn't really performed. But the fact that he's backed himself and gone, I'm going to Derby, I'm going to score loads of goals, and he has done, that when he comes back to Liverpool, he'll be thought about in a completely different light. Maybe Solanke's just thinking, oh, if I go there, it's a bit of a risk. Whereas Wilson's
It is a risk, but if you want to make it at the top club, then you have to take that risk. If you're sitting at a top club and you're not getting any minutes, then
look at Sancho.
What your options?
Exactly. I think the game is changed in that sense. That you look at Reece Nelson and Jadon Sancho off like providing evidence of how these Bundesliga teams seem a lot more willing and forthcoming with senior minutes. I think they're not even the first examples. Like you look at Ademola Lookman, who was on loan at RB Leipzig and made quite a big impression there. Desperate for a move away from Everton when he came back. That didn't materialise, obviously.
Reece Oxford went to Borussia Mönchengladbach as well, didn't he?
But
got some games.
I think as well, even if you don't, if you go on loan and you don't come back with amazing numbers, but you've played and got those games under your belt, then that's still more positive than just sitting on the bench for a season. Because to me, like Solanke is still unproven at senior level. I still see him as a young player, whereas you look at someone like Sancho and already you're seeing him as a senior player.
It's about proving it to yourself, I imagine, as much as anything. Because if you don't have any minutes to look back on yourself at the top level, you're going to start to doubt whether you're actually cut out for, for football at the top level.
I think it's a massive issue in terms of English football in general. Probably haven't got time on this podcast to discuss the whole thing, but if you look at, if you've ever been
let's
to a
just
Premier
really League, work through this and like solve the
if you've ever been to a Premier League 2 game or an under 23 game, whatever you want to call it, it's not representative of any type of football whatsoever. It's so slow, the tempo, there's nothing on the game, there's no fans there or any sort. And the problem you've got is when you look at Spain, for example, with the B teams, Barcelona can send their best young players to Barca B, where they're playing against proper teams, they're playing in full stadiums, they're playing against older players that this is their livelihood, they need to play well. So they're getting amazing development. Whereas in England, there's that bottleneck where, look at Loftus-Cheek, for example, previously, you get to a stage where you're too good for the under-23s, but you're not quite good enough for Chelsea. And there's just nowhere to go, because if no one wants you on loan, there's nowhere for you to go. So there's a massive issue in English football overall that youngsters, like Sancho, for example, are having to go abroad. And I think that's something we'll see more of, because English teams just cannot give them the game time they want.
But then, I mean, in my opinion, it's better for the big clubs or just the Premier League clubs in general to let their players go on loan to Championship clubs. If you want them to play, then, I mean, at the moment it seems to be a big buzzword of sending them abroad, but plenty of Championship clubs would have these players.
Yeah, I think it's just sort of the level is higher in if you can get them into a team sort of the Bundesliga. I know maybe like you could make the comparison between the Championship and Eredivisie, like the Eredivisie is the top level in Netherlands, but is it much superior to the Championship?
What I mean is, you know, if you're sitting in Chelsea's academy and you've been there for like 6 years and you're 18, then push for a loan move to a Championship club.
That's on the player's mentality, so it's up to that player. If that player's got the mentality to be like, yeah, I want to prove myself, but there's going to be a lot of kids there that have been like, oh, I'm earning really good money here, I'm training with all these players,
you don't know when your chance is going to come at that big club, and so if you take it, then bang, you're away at the club, aren't you? So
you've really got to pick your club as well. Like for Derby, it's a dream going there, because they've got like Jody Morris, who's demonstrated his sort of ability to coach young players for Chelsea's youth teams for season upon season.
Yeah, it was a win-win, wasn't it?
It's no coincidence that like Tomore, Wilson and Mason Mount are doing so well.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we've gone massively off topic there. So bringing it back to this weekend's games, and Atletico Madrid host Barcelona. And it's actually been 17 games since they last played out a 0-0 draw. So it's first versus third. Messi's going to be coming back sharper. Umtiti's going to return. Coutinho could. Do we think Barca can bounce back from their defeat to Betis?
Probably. Because I think Atletico have got some injury concerns themselves. I believe Diego Costa's back.
They've got no defenders out
there. Yeah, I think Godin's out. Coming away from defence. I think Koke might be out as well, and then potentially Jimenez.
They were talking about Saul as an option at centre back, because I think previously when he was younger, he has played at centre half.
I think he was in Portugal or something, wasn't he? And he was playing for Sporting or Benfica,
something like that.
I'm out on a limb there, so I'll retreat from that statement.
I think it might have been Raúl Zaragoza. I think he played centre back. I'm not sure.
Raúl Zaragoza. What did you say?
Zaragoza.
Okay.
Trying to pronounce it properly, you know.
Spanish listeners. Sorry, I stitched you up a bit.
But I think just off what you've said, I think Barcelona will bounce back. I think if you've watched Atletico Madrid this season, Diego Costa is not scoring at all. Griezmann hasn't been the same form. Saul is stuck in this rut where Simeone's got him into a position where he can't really express himself very much in that kind of midfield too, and it's difficult to watch them for Atletico Madrid. And I think it just proves that Simeone's just stayed that year longer than he maybe should have done, and that evolution hasn't quite happened. So I think Barcelona,
they are on a 6-game win streak or something at the Wanda right now. I think so. They're coming into it in good home form, and this is like the most beatable Barcelona have been in seasons. Like Lahanis and Real Betis have demonstrated that. so far this season. Yeah, and they defensively they look very suspect. I know Umtiti's coming back, but and that could be, make a big difference. But he is just coming back. Like,
yeah, but I think if you look at the table, there's teams like Alaves, Espanyol, Valladolid up there, and with Atletico Madrid, I think they should really have took advantage more of the opportunities they had.
Yeah, like, did you see the comparison this week between Arsenal and Barcelona? I think they're on like the sort of
the same number of points,
same number of wins, and yet they're first in La Liga, whereas Arsenal are fifth or fourth, which is a fifth probably. Should probably have checked that. Fifth sounds right.
we can block the sound and we can hear this out. They're fifth at the moment. Yes, Will. Yeah. Sorry, do that again.
So we'll keep this in.
So a draw would obviously be best for Real Madrid, but do we think it would be best for La Liga as well?
100%. They'll be like, I think, 1 point off Real Madrid. If they spank Eibar this weekend, which is quite somewhat of a tricky game, so probably won't get like the 4-0 win. They'd need to surpass Atletico Madrid on goal difference or whatever.
Yeah.
Then they're like, yeah, exactly. They could be sort of just behind Barcelona in like third or something, depending on how would the results go around them, because it's so like gridlocked in that point that it's difficult to really anticipate how the top six is going to look by the end of the game week.
Yeah, I can't see anything other than a Barcelona win personally.
I mean, Atletico, they're at home, and you wouldn't put it past them to sort of to pull out a sort of defensive performance even without the top defenders there, because I mean Diego Simeone's coached so many like top class defenders that it's obviously like the system as much as the talent. So
the main reason why I'm basing that on is the fact that Barcelona lost in their last game, and Messi's going to be hurting, and that's probably the most dangerous player.
True.
When he's hurting and when he's like craving that win again, that's a really, really dangerous player to have. Probably the best player in the world.
I think that they're probably favourites, but you know, it's Atletico Madrid. You can't write them off.
Very true. So that's all we've got time for today. I'd like to say thank you to Will.
Very welcome. Always a pleasure.
And Nathan.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me on.
And thanks to you all for listening. We'll catch you next time.